So why don't you announce your presence? Say hello. Whoops. Okay. So who's here?
It's Hayward in Tucson.
Hi, Hayward.
Michael.
Okay, Robert and Michael.
Roger in Ames.
Well, good. Good. David F. Okay.
Bridget in Berkeley.
Yeah.
Duncan in Holland.
Great. Anyone else? No? Okay, we're missing a few people so far, but let's assume we'll have more who join us as we go along. So, I was just...
I am muting, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Dog.
Okay. So I was just looking at people's comments during the week. I didn't actually post anything, but I really appreciate what people are doing in their online posts. There was a nice exchange between Bruce and Karin, neither of whom are here right now, but I say it was nice in the sense that I would really like to encourage people to comment on each other's posts and use them as a way of exploring your own experience, and I thought that happened very nicely in that exchange. So, keep posting and sharing with each other, and I think that will only deepen the experience. So, this week we are dealing with the issue of interpretation. Interpretation kind of falls in between models and experience. I think as we go along this week, we'll see something about that question, which we've been exploring. And in a way, the question is just, it just grows out of the fact that I assigned the readings in a certain way. We started with stories, and then we shifted over to models. If I had started with models, we never would have been asking about, how do models connect to stories, or at least not very much. But the reason I did it that way is because, I don't know if I can put it into words that well, but it just seemed to me that first to get clear on the role that stories play in our lives, and then to see how they get constructed, and how it's, in a sense, it's very much like constructing a model. You could even say like constructing an argument, but that would probably just confuse things. But it's like any kind of construct, any way we put things together to make sense out of them, and that was the sense that I wanted to convey in connecting up models and stories. Now, the first paragraph of the reading makes a distinction or sets in contrast models and experience. The second sentence says, the first sentence says we have to put aside models. And then it says, unless we turn directly to experience, in other words, unless we put aside models and turn directly to experience, we will continue to play one model off against another, trading in old belief structures for new ones. Now, that's not the final version, I don't think. I think that's something that makes sense in this chapter, but the issue that immediately comes up is if you look at stories, you see that our experience is really the outgrowth of stories, and that's what we've been looking at. So it's not as though you can get to a realm of pure experience, and that's something we've talked about repeatedly. And I think the chapter really moves us in that direction too, through this focus on interpretation. So it starts off by saying, models are problematic, we need to get to pure experience, but when we turn to pure experience, it turns out that there isn't such a thing because it's really just another model or interpretation, and the language here shifts from models to interpretations, and then it's going to shift from interpretations to stories, and we will find ourselves back talking about stories, and especially talking about the self, which is where we're going to be headed next week. So what we've already seen, because we started off with the whole discussion of stories and dynamics of time and space, is that experience itself is the stories that we are living, the stories that we are inhabiting, and that, in a sense, we could say we experience our story. And I want to come back to an image that I've used often and seems to me helpful, and that is the image of a movie or a novel. If you think of a character in a novel, that character inhabits the novel, right? The character doesn't live anywhere else. And in fact, we would say, you know, that's why a character is fictional, because the character is just made up. But essentially that same model, and this is a model, essentially that same model applies to our experience. We construct this story, and of course we don't necessarily do it ourselves. It may be a story that we learn as we're growing up. If you watch children growing up, you see that an awful lot of what happens, what's involved in shaping a child into an adult, is creating or educating, leading the child into the right kinds of stories, the stories that will help the child make sense out of their lives and fit into society and so on. So we find our way into these stories and we learn to inhabit them. And of course, we've talked a lot about the problems that that brings. So I actually wanted to talk a little about exercise 9 in that light. We haven't really talked about it much yet, and it did come up in the posts that people had, including that exchange between Bruce and Karen that I was talking about earlier. But let me just stop and make sure that you know what we've talked about so far is clear. Are there any questions or comments about that? I must be very good at explaining things. Okay. Well, let's talk about exercise 9 a little bit, and I thought we could actually do it for a few minutes. But first, let's talk about it a little bit. So the starting point is space, and that might seem like a funny place to start if what you're going to be looking at is ultimately is thoughts, or the way we're using it, stories, thoughts and stories, kind of related, well, very strongly related to each other. It might seem like a funny place, but it makes a lot of sense if you think about it in terms of inhabiting a story, because the story becomes something like the space that we move in, the environment, the setting, with its own horizon. And again, it helps to think about a novel if you say, how does a character come into existence? Well, through inhabiting the story in somewhat the same way that we inhabit our lives, our world. And the way that we inhabit the world, you know, one of the things we say is, well, we inhabit physical space. And that's true. And that's the difference between us, you could say, and characters in novels. They don't inhabit physical space. They only inhabit the space of a novel. And that puts pretty severe limits on what they're able to do. They're only able to do what the novelist lets them do, and we got into all that when we were looking, you know, whether we talked about it or not. All of that is implicit in that movie, Stranger Than Fiction. But the fact that we inhabit physical space can be a little bit misleading. That's just one aspect of the space that we inhabit, or the story that we inhabit. We happen to be beings that have physical bodies that inhabit physical space. And that's not just some little sidelight. That's absolutely crucial and critical to who we are. But still, it's just a version of space as story, you could say. And so the exercise starts off by having us look at space. And then it moves on to the senses. And somebody asked the question, I think it was Bruce, in the posts during the week, just said, well, I didn't quite understand that part B of the exercise, which asks us to focus on the senses. And he said it was abstract. It seemed kind of abstract. And I think that's actually true in terms of the description. It's very, very brief. The instructions in the exercise don't tell you a thing about how to do that, about how to expand the inquiry into space, into the realm of the senses. Maybe that's intentional. Maybe it's so that we can do it in our own way without trying too hard to follow instructions, because following instructions is always, it always means that you start off with a model, and that can be pretty limiting. But I'm going to try to give you a little sense of it anyway, and just in case you want to explore it. It has to do, if you look at hearing and seeing, which are the two main senses, the sensory realms that we inhabit, how would you focus on the space dimension of those? Well, it has to do with, I'm sure there's lots of ways to do this, but the way that I am most familiar with has to do with the structure of someone hearing something or someone seeing something. So when we look at space, the suggestion was made to look at things like distance and separation and the kind of specific spatial qualities. And you can apply exactly those same qualities to sensory experiences, where when you hear something, our usual way of hearing something is to put all of the emphasis really on what's heard, on identifying it and labeling it. And once we've done that, we can kind of set it aside. We know what it is. Or perhaps the sound really moves us. Now, if the sound really moves us, that starts to take it in the direction of space, because now we're sensitive not only to the source of the sound, but to our own reaction. And that already is kind of opening up the space between the one that hears and what is heard. And then there's the distance separating the two. So those are the kinds of things you'd look at. Actually, I think that part B is very much an outgrowth of part A, where you're looking at space more directly. And then part C is thoughts and stories, and I think the posts were very helpful in giving a sense of how people have been working with that. So I'm not going to say too much about it. So my suggestion, because I am always looking for ways to get people engaged in these phone calls, so that it's not just me talking. My suggestion is that we spend a few minutes, maybe about 3 minutes or so, working with this exercise, and then see what people have to say, either about this specific instance of working with the exercise, or something that's come up as you've worked with the exercise during the last couple of weeks, because we've been doing it for a couple of weeks now. And in doing it, focus on any part of it you like. Maybe try first to tune into the sense of space, but maybe you just do that for 20 seconds or whatever. Or maybe you do it the whole time. It's up to you. We'll do it for about 3 minutes, okay? Okay, let's do it. Okay, let's stop there. It was interesting. One of the things that struck me in doing this is that just now is that the sense of space is so different because it's as though we're reaching out thousands of miles, right? Because here we are, everybody's occupying his or her own space, but we're also sharing in that space. But that's probably not too important. So who would like to say something about their experience?
It became clear that space allows experience.
Okay, can you say a little more about that?
That there was room for any appearance, anything that I saw, and there was that was quote external, and there was room for or space for anything that I experienced internally. That all the experiences and appearances are occurring in a space that allows it.
Yeah, you know, I think that's actually, it's really important to recognize because it's such a key thing in the TSK vision and with respect to space that we are so accustomed to understanding space in physical terms. And if we continue to insist on that, we can't get very far with TSK because TSK is really talking about space as this allowing or accommodating quality. I'm glad that became more clear or apparent. It's not as though you have to talk yourself into that. You know, it's not as though you have to turn that into a new model. That may be a step along the way. But what matters is to begin to experience the space that you inhabit in that more spacious way. Okay, someone else?
Yes. I noticed first just the sounds happening around me and focus on them, and it took a while before I could find that space. And when I did, of course, it's very, very brief. It's just a tiny sliver, and it feels almost like a vacuum. There's nothing in there, but I noticed that I'm very quickly full of some kind of interpretation or sense of what that particular sound means to me. Like a car going by in the rain, that's kind of pleasant. A child's voice, that's pleasant. An ambulance, that's not pleasant. things like that. But my point is I fill that little space very quickly.
Right. Okay, I'm going to paraphrase what you said because there was a little echo in what you were saying, so I just want to make sure people heard it, that you started off with a sense, or you had little moments of space as a kind of an emptiness or a vacuum was the word you used, but you filled it very quickly with your labels and identifications and reactions, pleasant, unpleasant,
yeah.
And so on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what we do, and so this exercise is meant to maybe help us step back a little bit from that. Okay, anyone else?
Robert here, Jack.
Yeah.
I had this happen a couple times during this exercise, but when I switched to the five senses, I started having this thought creep in, space is offering a lot more than my five senses can pick up. Uh-huh. And, you know, using the example of some people can see smells, for example, or you know, ultraviolet lights we can't see either. And that, you know, there's more there that could be communicated if we had, you know, some other senses as well. And there's a much greater density or communication coming from the space that we can't necessarily pick up. And just sort of playing around with that idea.
So as you played around with it, how did that shift or did it?
It just kind of made me more aware of the different kinds of things space could offer, and then sort of playing with the senses, sort of combining, you know, the sense of smell with visual, and seeing if somehow those joining together gave me a different sense of space, and it seemed to give a different sort of sense of the experience.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of combine a couple of senses together, or try to merge all five senses together at once, and try to just take the whole thing in sort of totality. So it, I don't know if I can't get real conclusions, but it's just a different sense of space.
Mm-hmm. Well, the whole model, you know, that we have these five senses and that we're the owner of our sensory experience and that we interpret it in certain ways, that is definitely a model.
Yeah.
And holding on to that is a way of closing down space. So that is another direction in which this exercise could go, that you would open up the possibilities for space within sensing, and then maybe sensing would become something different. One thing that leads me to is that although the exercise moves from space to senses to thoughts, and that kind of gives the impression that, visually, that, you know, space is at the bottom and then thought is the more complicated layer up on top, kind of like, you know, the waves on the ocean, and that's a model that's used. There is another sense in which thoughts, because they're the vehicles for our models and interpretations, are the most fundamental, and they are what are telling us what is possible for space. So when we're working with space, we're already working with a story or a model or interpretation of what space is. And so we're already kind of doing part three of the exercise in doing part one. There's an interplay there that is interesting. Okay, well, let's move on a little bit. Unless someone else want to say something? Okay. So let's see. The chapter talks about, you know, it goes from models and then it goes to facts, and basically saying we like to think that facts are more basic than the models that we construct, and that models are intended to let us discover facts. But in fact, and you wind up using these words all the time, in fact, what counts as a fact is the outcome of a model, just as what counts as space or what counts as sensory experience is the outcome of a model or a certain particular understanding. And one of the things I like to remind people of is that the word fact actually means something that has been created or done, you know, as in the word manufacture. A fact is something that is not quite made up. That's a little bit too strong, although fact and fiction, those two words are related to each other. But it's something that's been made. It's not something that you find lying around. And the way it gets made is, that's what this approach is pointing out, is it gets made by the models that we adopt. So that's part of what the chapter is saying. But you know, I always like to emphasize, and for some people this is old news. I mean, some of you understand this clearly. But there is a tendency in TSK to say, oh, well, this is cool. This is a new kind of philosophical understanding, you know, and we can see that science has its limitations because it thinks that it's trying to discover reality as it is or discover the facts, and it turns out that really reality is manufactured. That's all true. But we really need to apply it to our lives, and that's the point that I keep wanting to return to, because otherwise it can get kind of abstract. And there is a place right on the bottom of the first page where that becomes very clear. It's the last sentence. Rinpoche says, "The world that we are accustomed to, even in its most direct and immediate manifestations, is an intricate and overlapping complex of models built up out of interpretations, presuppositions, concepts, meanings, values, and memories." So, although I wouldn't say that list is complete, it at least reminds us that we are not talking about the abstractions that we use when we're thinking philosophically or scientifically. We're talking about our meanings, our values, our concerns, our cares. We're talking about what matters to us. And TSK goes to that level. It's not enough to say, oh, I've got a better argument than you do, or I've got a better philosophy than you do. This is a question of how we live. I think that's probably pretty clear to everybody, but as I said, I just wanted to return to it again. Now, I said before that there's this distinction that gets made in the first paragraph of the chapter between experience and models, and it sounds like the two are in opposition to each other. But, of course, you do need to understand also that experience is a model. That our version of what our experience is like is based on certain models, which then get worked up, you could say, into stories. And that doesn't get talked about so specifically in this chapter, although Rinpoche does say at the top of page 139, he talks about the facts of human experience. We think we understand what those facts are, and as a result, we think we understand what is possible for our experience. And that's really where this is headed. So I want to look at another place for a moment that emphasizes this kind of immediacy, this the significance of this for our lives, and that is the last full paragraph on page 141, which I think I referred to in the little introductory essay too. So he's talking about interpretive structures, and he says there's no solid foundation for knowledge. And then he asks a series of questions. And it's these questions kind of point to what gets called into play when you do this kind of inquiry. He says, when we have an experience within time, who has the experience and where? Does the mind receive the content of what we know, or does it create it? When we ask ourselves a question, is the answer an echo of the question? If there is confusion, who is confused? And let me just stop with that one, because I know that this issue of confusion comes up for people. And that's just such a wonderful basic question. You know, we find ourselves feeling confused, or we could just as well say we find ourselves feeling emotional, we find ourselves feeling upset, we find ourselves making judgments. So who's the one who's doing that? Right? You could ask a lot of other questions. You know, what is the substance of that feeling? How much does it depend on our identification? But the only point that I'm trying to make right now is that we can have all sorts of really interesting ways of looking at the world, but then we wind up reacting to our experience in the same old ways, and we don't have any way of connecting that theoretical understanding, that distanced understanding of what is so, with our experience. And the TSK vision is absolutely about giving us ways to be more free from the thoughts, the structures, the identifications, the labels that we use. So if we're confused, there is someone who's confused. Well, who is that someone? And if that feeling of confusion settles in on us, what is the setting? What is the space within which confusion operates? How does it pervade that space? And is that really the most fundamental space? Or is there a space that underlies that, in which the space that is pervaded by confusion just dissipates? Those are the kinds of questions we'd like to be able to ask. And I think that some of the things that people posted during the past week were good in suggesting the moments that come up when we're investigating in this way that do give us a sense of freedom, where we're not so identified. And that really is where we want to be looking. So there's a lot more we could talk about, but I think I'm going to stop there and just say that what's going to happen now is in the next week we're turning to the self. Let me go on for a minute or two longer and say something about the transition, you could say, to the self. What Rinpoche says in this chapter toward the end, he introduces this idea of the witness. And maybe we can talk about the witness more next week, or maybe that would be a good thing to be exchanging some comments on during the week. But let me say just a little bit about it. What he really says is, you can't rely on models, you can't rely on interpretations, and yet we all usually have a sense that there is something that is real and solid. And if we didn't have that sense, it would be pretty hard to function. And so he asks the question, what is that sense based on if it's not based on facts in the usual sense? And he really says it's based on a feeling. And so you can read that. I think the discussion is very clear. And actually, a few weeks ago, we did the exercise that he recommends here. He talks about imagining a light switch. I presented it a few weeks in terms of a light switch because that's how I remembered it. But he actually talks about a cup on the table. And it's really interesting that when he gives that example, he doesn't say, look at a cup on the table or look at something in front of you and now imagine it and look at that difference. He says, imagine a cup on a table and now imagining the cup on the table. So it's interesting because from the very beginning he throws us into this realm of completely made up, manufactured, fictional stuff. You could try it both ways and see what you think. But it's the feeling that he calls the witness. That's supposed to be our guarantor. And what he suggests is that feeling then gets translated into or immediately identified with the self. As the one who does the witnessing. So take a look at that. Go back over it if you feel you didn't understand it that well. But it will play very, very much into the reading that we do for next week, which is about the self and the founding story of the self. And the chapter talks about the different roles that the self plays. And one of them is the self as witness. So that's where we'll go next week. And I'm going to suggest an exercise for next week, which is actually the exercise at the end of the reading, exercise 21 in Love of Knowledge. It's called Protecting and Projecting. But I'll put that in the introductory essay. Anything before we close? No? Okay. Well, thanks. And we will talk together again next week.
Okay.